What I want to try to explain over the next 45 minutes is simply basically where I'm here and where I'm coming from. The Outsider, my first book, came out in 1956 when I was 24, and the basic obsession of The Outsider was the number of men of genius in the 19th century who'd either committed suicide or had died in stupid accidents like Shelley, but in any case, who seemed to feel a tremendous kind of despair about human existence. This despair always seemed to stem from the same source. They'd experienced certain moments in which they felt an ecstatic sense that the universe is infinitely exciting and that surely no human being should ever want to die. This is the kind of sense, for example, expressed in Van Gogh's painting The Starry Night, you know, where the trees look as if they're sort of green flames surging up towards the clouds, and the clouds themselves are a gigantic whirlpool of vitality. And yet, within a year of painting that, Van Gogh had committed suicide by shooting himself in the stomach and left behind a note which said, "Misery will never end." And the basic question that obsessed me was, which is true, The Starry Night or the suicide note? This is what I was writing about in The Outsider, about a number of people like Van Gogh who'd experienced the same sense of tremendous affirmation, followed by a feeling the next morning, what the hell was all that about? Was it merely a kind of drunkenness? Was it, in fact, an illusion? Now, I had been thinking about this ever since I was about 14 or 15. What obsessed me completely was the notion of science. I wanted to be a scientist. My great hero from the age of 11 onwards was Einstein. And then I began to experience a tremendous sense of despair as it struck me that there are certain fundamental things that not only we do not know, but apparently that we cannot know. And for example, where space ends. Well, wait until you finish. Now, The Outsider came out, as I say, in 1956. And a couple of years after The Outsider came out, I got a letter from an American professor of psychology called Abraham Maslow. What Maslow said was that he'd ceased to study sick people because sick people talked about nothing but their sickness. And so he'd asked around among his friends, who's the healthiest person you know? And they told him, and he'd got together about 50 or 60 of these extremely healthy people. And what he quickly discovered was something that nobody had ever discovered before, because nobody had ever bothered to study healthy people. That was that all of these healthy people had, with a fair degree of frequency, what Maslow called peak experiences, experiences of sudden bubbling, overwhelming happiness. And these peak experiences weren't mystical experiences. A young mother watching her husband and kids eating breakfast suddenly went into the peak experience as she thought, my God, aren't I lucky? Sailor who'd been in the Pacific for several years without seeing a woman came back to base and had a peak experience when he saw a nurse, because he said it suddenly struck him that women are different from men. He said we normally sort of think we know that, but in fact we don't really know it at all. G.K. Chesterton once said, we say thank you when someone passes the salt, but we don't mean it. We say the earth is round, but we don't mean it, even though it's true. And when the sailor suddenly realized that women are different from men, he was saying it, so to speak, and could mean it totally and completely. Now, I became fascinated by this and got to know Maslow, and in fact ended by writing a book about Maslow called New Pathways in Psychology. It seemed to me that obviously Maslow's peakers were having the same kind of experience as the romantics of the 19th century. But the problem with the romantics of the 19th century is that, I say, they had a basic despair about it. You remember Shelley writing about these moments of vision and the hymn to intellectual beauty, why dost thou go away and leave our state, this dim vast veil of tears, vacant and desolate? Always the feeling that there's nothing you can do to bring it back. Pushkin compared the poet's heart to a coal of fire, which is blown into a bright glow by the wind of inspiration and then goes dead and black again afterwards. Always that feeling that there's nothing you can do about it. Now, what I wanted to know was whether this was true. Was there some way, in fact, of achieving peak experiences at will? And there were various interesting clues. The story that always fascinated me was the story of Graham Greene and his Russian roulette. You remember that when Greene was a child at Berkhamsted School, which his father was headmaster, he sank into a condition of absolute misery and boredom. And particularly after he'd been under the care of a psychiatrist for 6 months, and said he'd never enjoyed himself so much with all this attention, and he emerged from this 6 months completely cured of his dislike of games and all kinds of other things, and but unfortunately found everything completely dead and flat. He said that he would look at a scene that he could see was beautiful visually, but would feel nothing whatever, just dead and grey inside. And then he found in a cupboard a revolver belonging to his older brother and took it out onto Berkhamsted Common and played Russian roulette. He put one bullet in the chambers, spun the chambers, pointed it at his head and pulled the trigger. And there was just a click, and he looked down the barrel and saw that the bullet had now come into position and experienced an overwhelming feeling of absolute sheer delight, the sudden feeling that the universe is infinitely exciting and interesting. And he actually went on to do that about 5 more times before even this began to bore him. Now, obviously, this method of achieving peak experiences has its dangers. And when finally I went along to Brandeis to meet Maslow, I talked about peak experiences and said, can you think of any possible way in which one can achieve a discipline to achieve peak experiences? And Maslow said, there's no such way. They come when they want to and they go when they want to. And this struck me as being completely counter to everything that Maslow believed, basically. Because Maslow was very fundamentally an optimist. He thought that Freud had sold human nature short, and he believed in what he called higher ceilings of human nature. And then Maslow told me a story which struck me as a kind of key to this whole problem. What Maslow said was that when his students began to talk to one another about peak experiences, they remembered peak experiences which they'd had in the past and which they had forgotten. And for example, a young man who was working his way through college as a jazz drummer suddenly found that 2 o'clock in the morning he just could not do a thing wrong, was drumming absolutely perfectly, and he went into the peak experience. And as his students began exchanging peak experiences, they not only began remembering peak experiences like that, but they began having peak experiences all the time. Obviously, merely turning your mind, so to speak, in that direction produces, to begin with, a curious optimism, which is the opposite of most of our fundamental assumptions about existence. And it seems that this optimism and the feeling that peak experiences are completely natural does actually produce peak experiences. So it seemed to me that I discovered something very interesting and important. I'd always taken it for granted, in fact, that the answer to that question, which is true, the starry night or the suicide note, is the starry night. Simply because when we experience these curious moods of intensity and affirmation, we see them, as it were, from above, from a bird's eye view, and you appear to see human existence spread out below you. Whereas when you're in a mood of gloom, it's a worm's eye view. And the worm's eye view is essentially, by its very nature, smaller than the bird's eye view. It's a kind of close-up. It's like going into a picture gallery, which has a dim light, and being forced to look at the pictures within 2 or 3 inches in order to see anything at all. But you wouldn't see the picture as a whole, you just see the texture of the canvas. The recognition that in these sudden moods of intensity, it's exactly like turning up the light in the picture gallery, so that you can suddenly stand back and see the picture as a whole. And as I say, get the bird's eye view. See the picture as a whole, and as I say, get the bird's eye view. Now, in 1969, an American publisher, Random House, approached me and said, would I write a book about the paranormal? Well, it wasn't a subject that interested me very deeply, but I needed the money and said okay. And I'd always been interested in the paranormal as a child. My grandmother had been a spiritualist. And with the thought that I was going to do this thing with my tongue in my cheek, I began studying the paranormal. I went to Mallorca at about this time as a kind of writer in residence at an American college there, and my neighbor was Robert Graves. And I said to Robert Graves, what advice would you give me about a book on the occult? And Robert Graves said, don't write it. And nevertheless, I did begin to find that certain things interested me deeply. My wife just happened to be reading a biography, one of those autobiographies of Osbert Sitwell, called Left Hand, Right Hand. And it happened to mention the fact that just before the First World War, Sitwell and a bunch of his brother officers had gone along to see a famous palmist in London. And she looked at their palms and obviously got very cagey and upset. And Sitwell said to her afterwards, what's the matter? And she said, I couldn't see anything in their palms. And of course, most of these were killed in the first few months of the war. Now, Sitwell was a total skeptic, and his father was a famous 19th century skeptic who used to go in for revealing fake mediums. And so it struck me that, you know, people like this obviously had something serious to say about the so-called paranormal, especially when I came across a comment by Andrew Lang to the effect that nearly all of the people he's ever come across who had some paranormal experience had just had one single paranormal experience and, you know, didn't really believe in it apart from that. Now, what struck me as so interesting about this whole question of the paranormal was that he seemed to indicate that we possess powers which we don't normally recognize that we possess and which sound completely absurd. I mean, for example, a friend of mine, a good musician, was returning late at night from a concert along the Bayswater Road in a taxi, when he suddenly knew with absolute certainty that at the Queensway turning, a taxi would shoot out across the traffic lights and would hit them sideways. And he thought, shall I tell the driver? They think I'm completely mad. And at the Queensway crossing, a taxi shot out and hit them sideways. Now, we cannot know the future. The future hasn't yet happened. It's an impossibility. And yet there are thousands of well-authenticated cases of knowing the future. Clearly there's something seriously wrong with our human notion about time. And as I discovered case after case of this sort, I became more and more fascinated. It seemed quite obvious that what I was talking about was in a way something very similar to the experience of 19th century outsiders, except that they experienced a kind of mystical flash. And my people involved in the paranormal and the occult experience, as it were, states of insight that we should not have. This is what interested me so much, these states of insight. And also the implication they seem to have, that we are in some funny way able to influence the external world in a way that we don't understand. A historian, A.L. Rouse, I deliberately approached poets, artists, that kind of thing, to ask them about their own experiences, and Rouse is a very good poet. Told me that he'd once been leaning out of a window, feeling very gloomy, over his Oxford quadrangle, and had noticed that it was an exceptionally heavy sash window, and that if it broke, it would chop his head off. And he'd been feeling so depressed that he said to himself, oh, let the damn thing fall, and then pulled in his head, and the window came down like a guillotine. And once again, Rouse suddenly, looking out of his window, had a strong intuition that if he crossed over two quadrangles and went into the library, he'd find two young men embracing. And if he walked across two quadrangles, and sure enough, in the library, there were two young men embracing. Experiences like that convince me that we appear to have some curious power or ability that we don't really understand. Now, in Washington, in 1966. One morning I suddenly had an insight that seemed to me to bind a lot of this together. I was thinking about Proust and about Proust's description in the beginning of Swan's Way, how coming in very tired one evening, he'd been given a little cake called a Madeleine and a cup of herb tea. and that dipping the madeleine in the herb tea and tasting it, he'd suddenly experienced a strange feeling. He said, I'd ceased to feel mediocre, accidental, mortal. And wondering why he felt the sheer joy, he tried again, and the second time remembered what it was all about. That as a child in Combray, when he came in from a long walk, his Aunt Leonie used to give him the same kind of little madeleine dipped in herb tea, and that it had brought back with tremendous force his childhood in Combray. A few moments before, he could have said, yes, I was a child in Combray, but he wouldn't have meant it. Now suddenly he could say, I was a child in Combray, and it really meant something. It's this degree of reality that things achieve. The French psychologist Janet talked about the reality function. And that's what it's all about. We have a function inside us that makes things more real in certain moments. Normally they're sort of thin carbon copies of reality. And suddenly when the brain is stimulating, and obviously Graham Greene playing Russian roulette did exactly the same thing. He stimulated the reality function. Now, Arnold Toynbee had also described the same kind of thing. He said that he'd been climbing Mystra, to the citadel of Mystra, which is on Mount Taygetus in Greece, looking down on the plain of Sparta. And Mystra has been a complete wreck for nearly two centuries now, ever since the war in which Lord Byron was killed. Sitting there, he said, looking down on the plain of Sparta and chewing a bar of chocolate and completely relaxed, he suddenly looked at the ruins around him, and it struck him with tremendous force that just over a century ago, the Turks came over that wall there and massacred everyone in the city, and ever since then, Mystra has been a ruin. And he said it was so totally real that he could almost see them. And in the last volume of The Study of History, which this particular experience inspired him to write, he describes 10 similar experiences in which he says it was like falling down a time pocket, like an aeroplane falling down an air pocket, and suddenly this immense sense of the reality of some other point in history. Now, this was obviously a kind of heightened imagination. He describes even how once, walking past the wall of Victoria Station, he had a sense of all history simultaneously. He said it suddenly, the reality of the whole of history hit him, and in that moment he saw it as a kind of river in which his own life was a tiny little wavelet, a ripple that disappeared almost immediately. And that it struck him as amusing that he should have had such a strange vision with something as commonplace as the wall of Victoria Station passing by on his left-hand side. But Toynbee also described once that looking at the site of another battlefield in Greece of much later date, again this overwhelming sense of reality, which actually made him feel that he could see what was happening, but he also appeared to see a rider galloping away from the scene of the battle, about whom he knew nothing at all. Now, if Toynbee had looked this up and discovered that in fact a rider did gallop away, this would be a very interesting proof of some paranormal faculty, but in fact, study as hard as he would, he still could not find anything about this rider galloping away. Nevertheless, in these moods, which I call Faculty X, we do appear to have this curious power to grasp the reality of other times and other places beyond the present. And I would suggest that a painting like The Starry Night was painted in a state of consciousness very close to Faculty X. Now, it seemed to me that this whole study of the paranormal was obviously very close to my study of existentialism and the outsider, that in fact it fitted in neatly into it. And particularly Toynbee and these experiences of Faculty X. And particularly Toynbee and these experiences of Faculty X. I myself just once or twice had similar glimpses, but nearly always they'd been through some peculiar kind of discipline. And for example, one New Year's Eve, I'd gone to a lecture in a remote farmhouse in the middle of Devon. And that night it snowed and snowed and snowed, and the next morning we got up and there was sort of snow up to all the windows, and none of us could get out. And after we'd been stuck there for 24 hours, we determined we'd got to make an effort to get out of the place. And all of us tried to get our cars out of the farmyard, which was down in the bottom of a hollow. And oddly enough, my car was the only one whose wheels would actually grip and get up out of the farmyard. And then all of us grabbed shovels, and as we drove along, as I drove along, they formed, tossed the snow out of the path, and so on. It took us 2 or 3 hours to reach the gate, which was about 3/4 of a mile away. At the end of which, I went back to the farm and had lunch, and then walked back and got into the car and gave a lift to a girl who also wanted to go in the same direction. I quickly discovered that having got out on the main road, I had to drive very carefully indeed, because the snow was piled so high that you couldn't see where the ditch was. And if I wasn't very careful in these narrow country lanes, I was going to find myself just as badly off as before, stuck in a ditch and unable to get out. So I was forced to concentrate extremely hard as I drove. And I concentrated like this until finally we got onto the main road some hour and a half or 2 hours later. I then discovered that having concentrated like that for so long, I didn't just relax, but the state of intense concentration remained, and everything I looked at looked deeply interesting. Everything seemed to have implications apart from itself. And it seemed quite clear to me that what I'd done was to induce faculty X, or a variety of faculty X, by sheer frantic concentration over nearly 2 hours. And this, more than anything else, is my basic, my own personal basic discipline. I'm not very good at it, but this is what I do to attempt to push my consciousness up to a slightly higher level. Now, it has always seemed to me that the human race is on the point of an evolutionary leap to a higher phase, and that we are now very close indeed to it. And I come to this conclusion because of the outsider. It seems that what has happened to the human race fairly recently is extremely interesting. In the year 1740, a printer called Samuel Richardson wrote the first novel. He wrote it in the form of letters from a maidservant to her mother. It was called Pamela. And he'd started off by writing a book about how to write letters. And then he decided that one of the characters he'd invented was so good that he'd make it into a novel. And he produced this book, Pamela, in which the maidservant says, my mistress has just died, but the young master has been very good to me and says, Pamela, you shall be my personal servant, and so on. And the letter ends, you know, I'm a little worried. The young master just came in and looked at me in a sort of rather strange way and put his hand on my shoulder. And of course, for the remainder of the novel, the young master does his best to get Pamela into bed. At one point, he even more or less kidnaps her and has her taken away to another of his houses, and the housekeeper tries to hold her down while he rapes her. And she has a fit or something of the sort, and it doesn't happen. And the young master ends by marrying her. Well, this thing became a bestseller. It absolutely rolled its way across Europe. Suddenly, everybody was reading Pamela. It was the first novel in our modern sense of the word. There had been novels before then, like Robinson Crusoe, which was basically a realistic story about a real person, or Gulliver's Travels, which was basically a satire. But Pamela was about the girl next door. It was the first soap opera. And quite suddenly, everybody began writing novels. Richardson himself wrote another enormous novel called Clarissa, in which the girl actually does get raped in the end. And it's quite obvious that one reason that everybody read these novels was to see whether Pamela got raped. The interest was in sex. He'd written the first novel that basically was about sex. And when people attacked him on this, he said, but it's a highly moral novel. I'm trying to show that if a girl remains virtuous and puts up fierce resistance, she ends up as the lady of the manor. Which, you know, sounded true enough. But of course, from then on, people began writing novels that were basically about sex. I mean, Matthew Lewis's The Monk is a sort of quite horrific novel with rapes and all the rest of it in it. And always saying, you know, that it is all highly moral. I emphasize that it's about sex because, once again, sex is one of those enormous, deep, basic human forces that rumbles up in us like lava out of a volcano, and that for the time being produces a state of intense concentration. Dr. Johnson once said, when a man knows that he's to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. And when you come to think of it, sex is one of the very other few things that concentrates our minds wonderfully. That's the basic reason for its popularity. And in other words, that sex induces for a moment something like faculty X. Now, what happened was very interesting. The novel took off from Samuel Richardson onwards, and by the mid-19th century, novels had become fairly commonplace. And what the novel meant, in effect, was that a bored housewife living in the middle of nowhere with nothing else to do, who before had been forced to read volumes of sermons because that was the only thing that was around to read. Volumes of sermons were always bestsellers in the early part of the 18th century, because you went to church on Sunday, the vicar told you a story, as it were, and you came out of church really feeling that you'd escaped. It was like a theatre or a cinema. And so you went and bought the volume of sermons as soon as it came out and repeated the experience. Samuel Richardson put a sudden end to the popularity of sermons, and everybody began writing novels. But what this meant in effect was that people were taking a kind of mental voyage. You sat down reading Pamela, or let's say in the 19th century, one of the novels of Jane Austen or the Brontes or something of the sort, and your mind took off on a magic carpet into another realm. You became Pamela or Heathcliff for a few hours. And this freeing of the human imagination always seemed to me to be the foundation of some great evolutionary change. And it seems to me that we're very close indeed to it, to that kind of concentration, to that kind of control of consciousness that led Maslow's students to discover they could have peak experiences whenever they liked. Clearly, if we could do this, we would have solved that problem that made Van Gogh and so many other people in the 19th century commit suicide. And now, this explains why I'm here today. In 1979, I got for review John Anthony West's book Serpent in the Sky, and was immensely interested by his account of an Alsacian scholar called René Schwaller de Lubecks. And Schwaller de Lubecks was a kind of maverick Egyptologist who'd first of all been interested in alchemy, the sort of serious study of alchemy. Ben had gone to Egypt with his wife and started to study the Temple of Luxor. He'd been fascinated to begin with because he discovered in one of the tombs a right-angle triangle with the pharaoh as the hypotenuse, but it was a 3-4-5 Pythagorean triangle. And he realized that this was some 2,000 years before the existence of Pythagoras, and the Egyptians obviously knew a great deal more than we think. The fact that the Egyptians apparently knew the precise circumference of the earth, again, seems to show that, you know, they knew a great deal more than we can explain. Anyway, Schwaller had taken one look at the Sphinx and said, that's not weathered by wind and sand, that's weathered, in fact, by water. And as you know, John suddenly thought that, you know, this appeared to be a way of definitely proving the thing one way or the other, because Schwaller had also cited a tradition that the Sphinx were built by survivors from Atlantis thousands of years before anybody thought. This mention of the word Atlantis obviously is the kind of thing that horrifies anyone who takes the subject seriously. And Schwaller himself had been completely ignored, but he nevertheless spent about 20 years in Egypt and ended by writing an enormous book about the Temple of Luxor called The Temple of Man, which is just being translated. Now, I was fascinated by this, but there seemed to be no way of carrying the subject any further, although at the same time, I reviewed a new edition of Charles Hapgood's book on the maps of the ancient sea kings. And once again, found this fascinating simply because, as you know, Hapgood was an American teacher at Keene State University and or college, and he'd become extremely interested in these ancient maps called Portolans, which means from port to port, of medieval mariners. He'd been particularly interested in one map that had been made by a medieval Turkish mariner called Piri Reis. Piri Reis, apparently he was Admiral Reis, and he had being fascinated to see that it showed the whole coast of South America and the South Pole, but it showed the South Pole looking quite different from the South Pole today. It showed it as having enormous bays around Queen Maud Land. Now, an expedition to Antarctica in 1949 had tried sonar soundings down through a mile of ice and had found that these bays really existed. And obviously, somebody rather knew all about this. How did they manage to get into medieval maps when undoubtedly Antarctica which incidentally weren't discovered until the 19th century, Antarctica must have been covered by the same layer of ice. And what Hapgood finally decided was that obviously there must have been some much, much older civilization. And I won't go into the detail of this because it's something you probably already know. But what Hapgood said finally was that all of the evidence seemed to point to some worldwide maritime civilization which existed as long ago as about 7,000 BC, and that these ancient maps seem to prove beyond all doubt that it had to exist. There's even a map by a man called Philip Bouache, which, again, one of these early cartographers, which shows Antarctica as two enormous islands. Now, in point of fact, we now know that Antarctica was two enormous islands, and that once again it's all covered over with ice. But other maps show the interior of Antarctica with great detail. Nobody would have any interest in mapping the inside of a country in great detail except somebody who actually lived there. So it looked as if there was a time when Antarctica was free of ice, and when pretty certainly it was a seagoing civilization. So these two things came together at the same time, both in 1979. In the early 1990s, I was asked to write a kind of film outline about Atlantis for a producer called Dino De Laurentiis, who said, "Do you know anything about Atlantis?" And I said, "I know everything about Atlantis," and sent him a long article I'd written about it. And Dino told me to sort of go ahead. And I decided to base this thing upon John West's comments about the Sphinx being built by the survivors from Atlantis, around about probably, according to Plato, 9,500 BC. And while I was working on this, I received quite out of the blue, and by pure chance, a letter from John West telling me that he had been to look at the Sphinx with Robert Schock, and that Schock had said, "Yeah, sure, that's definitely wind and rain weathering, not wind and sand. You know, the profile looks quite different. Wind and sand produces a profile like that. The hard rock sticks out and the soft rock is worn away. Rain weathering coming down from overhead is basically the same sort of thing, except it also cuts channels downwards through the rock, so it looks like a series of buttocks side by side. And this is what the Sphinx enclosure, in fact, looks like. As you know, the Sphinx originally was probably some kind of chunk of granite sticking out of the ground, out of the limestone. And what they did was to slice down, to begin with, they cut an enormous block of limestone with the granite sticking out where the Sphinx's head at present is. And then they carved this into the shape of the lion's body. The rest of the limestone, which they cut out in huge blocks, they took to build the Sphinx temple and the valley temple, which are in front of it. But they took 200-ton blocks to do this with. And when Graham Hancock was writing Fingerprints of the Gods, he got his researcher to find out how many cranes in the world could in fact shift 200-ton blocks. There were only three. And the question was, how do you move a 200-ton block if you're living 2,500 BC? But of course, when Schock looked at the Sphinx, he said that he thought that its age was probably round about 7,500 BC. And it was at this point that I really came back into the story, because I was sent an account of this conference at San Diego in which this had been put to a group of geologists. And oddly enough, the geologists had been very enthusiastic and said, "Yep, that sounds good and sensible." Now, it was at this point that along came Robert Bovall and came up with very good reasons why, if the Sphinx was much, much older than anybody thought, then probably the age would be something more like 10,500, not 7,500. I'm not going to go into the details of all this because there's not really time, but as you know, it's based upon this notion of the precession of the equinoxes. What Bovall had noticed one night when he was in the desert alone was that the three stars of Orion's belt, and as you know, Orion is shaped like an hourglass with three little dots across the middle, the three stars of Orion's belt were exactly in the same conformation as the three pyramids at Giza, which had bothered him when he'd seen an aerial photograph of them in the Cairo Museum, because he couldn't see why they're in such a strange order. Two big pyramids, the pyramid of Cheops and the pyramid of Chephren, all in a dead straight line, and then much smaller, and as it were to the south, the pyramid of Menkaure. Why have they put the pyramid in such an odd position, and why was it so out of line with the others? And of course the three stars of Orion's belt gave him the answer, and he shouted, I've got it! The only problem was that the Egyptians believed that the heavens were an exact reflection of the earth, and that their land of Egypt, in fact, was a reflection of the heavens. In fact, if those three stars in the sky were a reflection of the three pyramids on the ground, then they didn't exactly correspond, for a very simple reason, because of this phenomenon known as the precession of the equinoxes. You know, as you know, if you stuck a pencil through the earth from top to bottom, the top of the pencil would sort of go around in a small circle. In other words, the earth is rocking a bit like a cradle as it goes around. But it takes an enormously long time, 26,000 years, to complete one rock, so to speak. But obviously, if the earth is rocking like a cradle, then the stars are slowly going up in the sky, also taking 26,000 years, sort of half of that time to go up and half of that time to come down. Now, in fact, there's only one time, and incidentally I should add that, of course, they go up as if they're on the hand of a clock. And you can see that on the hand of a clock, the actual position of Orion is going to change as it goes up and down. Now, the only time when those three stars across Orion's belt exactly mirror the three pyramids on the ground was in 10,500 BC, when they're at the bottom of their cycle. And so Bobel came to the conclusion that they must have had some reason for wanting to declare 10,500 BC to be an extremely important date. Anyway, all of this certainly fascinated me, but I found myself asking, in a way, the question, so what? What does it matter? And then, when I began to go more deeply into it, I began to see that indeed it was very, very closely connected with the problem that had preoccupied me all this time for nearly 40 years. You see, what had always bothered me so much was this question of the evolution of man. Man's evolved at an incredible rate in terms of geological time. A mere half million years ago, there occurred something we call the brain explosion, when man's brain in no time at all suddenly doubled its size. And we don't know why the brain explosion occurred. What we do know is that in the caves at Chukutien near Peking in the 1930s, they discovered the skulls of a person, a man who hadn't been discovered so far, that they called Peking Man, and that the back of these skulls all had large holes in them where something had been scooped out, and that the holes, they thought, had been made so that Peking Man could scoop out the brains of his enemies and eat them. Now, the cave was also full of antelope bones. Apparently his favorite meal was venison. So it certainly wasn't just hunger that made him eat his enemies. Now, all cannibalism that we know is basically a kind of ritual. It's done in order to gain the strength of your enemy. You can't imagine any kind of a ritual, any kind of a religious ritual, without some kind of language. You just can't have a ritual without some kind of communication other than grunts. And it suddenly struck me that if Peking Man did have some kind of ritual half a million years ago, then he'd already begun to use language, and this could well explain the brain explosion. Now, the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget, looking at some artifacts like spears and knives, made 330,000 years ago, declared that the men who made them were just as intelligent as modern man. But if they were as intelligent as modern man, what were they doing with their intelligence? They didn't even invent the bow and arrow. They didn't have any kind of art. They apparently didn't do anything at all. And the answer seems to be, people don't do anything with their intelligence, no matter how intelligent they are, unless they've got some kind of purpose. Think of those Russian novels of the 19th century where nothing ever happens in some small town. It just goes on and on and on and on. That's what it was like to be a human being 330,000 years ago. There was nothing to be a human being 330,000 years ago. There was nothing much to do. Then, along round about 100,000 years ago, came Neanderthal man. Neanderthal man, although he has a fairly bad reputation, was apparently a highly intelligent form of being. Neanderthal man, in fact, buried his dead with a religious ritual, dug enormous mines in hillside to mine red ochre, and mined literally millions of tons of red ochre, which he used for some ritual purpose. He also made sun disks, or at least he made flat, perfectly round disks, And also spheres that were, again, perfectly round. Why bother to make them unless they have some religious significance? But then, as you know, Neanderthal man disappeared. We don't know when. Maybe 50,000 years ago, and we suspect that our ancestors, Cro-Magnon man, killed him off. Now, the great question, to my mind, was, what was it that had caused this great surge of evolution with Cro-Magnon man? And I found the answer when I was writing this book, The Occult, in the 1970s. That is, that what had been recognized as a fairly late stage into the 20th century was that these drawings in caves like Lascaux, drawings of antelopes and of shamans dancing, wearing horns and all the rest of it, were not, in fact, the kind of thing that Cro-Magnon man, because he had nothing else to do after it got dark and lit candles and painted. They were part of a hunting ritual. And this hunting ritual was intended to catch the prey. And it really apparently does work. In The Occult, I'd been fascinated by a story about a man, told by a man called Sir Arthur Grimble, who was the land commissioner in the Gilbert Islands in the Pacific. Grimble had actually witnessed this. He'd been taken over one day to a village where they were going to hunt the porpoise, and what happened was the shaman disappeared into his hut and stayed there all day. And just as Grimble thought that nothing was going to happen, the shaman came running out shouting, "They're coming, they're coming!" And everybody in the village rushed into the sea, and suddenly, to Grimble's astonishment, porpoises were swimming in, dozens of porpoises, and didn't seem to feel any kind of fear of the human beings who helped to lift them ashore. Then the tide went out and left them high and dry, and then the villagers killed them with clubs and ate the meat. And when Grimble asked the shaman, "How did you do this?" he said, "Oh, well, I go into a dream, and in the dream, my dream body goes and invites the porpoises to come for dinner," without explaining that they were to be the dinner. Now, this kind of thing I came across again and again. And again, there's a remarkable book called Wizard of the Upper Amazon, written by F. Bruce Lamb. And F. Bruce Lamb had talked about a man called Manuel Cordova, who was, a Brazilian who'd been kidnapped by the Amahuaca Indians. And he'd been held captive for a while until the chief of the tribe had decided to make him the next shaman and taught him about shamanism. Now, one of the most interesting scenes in the book concerns where, after taking some kind of drug that the Indians had made themselves, they then jointly had visions of animals walking through the clearing. And one enormous black jaguar came walking through the clearing, which everybody associated with Cordova himself, which stopped and looked around, and everybody shivered, and then slowly walked on. Everybody was seeing it, just like sitting in a cinema. And Andrew Weil, the Californian psychologist who wrote an introduction, said that this is an authentic example of Jung's collective unconscious. And suddenly I began to see what we're really talking about is the collective unconscious. What suddenly hit me with great power was that these people possessed certain powers, and that these powers were to do with the fact that they were bound together. You ever seen a flock of birds in the air suddenly turning simultaneously, with apparently no communication, or a shoal of fishes in the water suddenly turning simultaneously? Obviously, in some way, they're all connected together. This is obviously what our ancestors were like. They were connected together in some basic way. Now, we appear to have got rid of this simply because we don't need it. In The Occult, I wrote about a tiger hunter called Jim Corbett. And Jim Corbett, in fact, had said that he was always able to tell when a tiger was lying in wait for him because he just suddenly experienced what he called jungle sensitivity. But clearly, we don't need jungle sensitivity in a modern civilization, and apparently we've got rid of it. But have we, in fact, got rid of it? At some computer meeting in Las Vegas in the early 1990s, a man called Kevin Kelly describes in a book called Out of Control the way that the whole audience of 5,000 people were given little rackets with red on one side and green on the other, so when they turned them towards the camera, an enormous monitor over the stage would show, you know, red on one side of the audience where they were holding the red rackets towards the camera and blue on green on the other side. The whole audience was then asked to play a game of electronic ping pong, which is usually played by kids between two different children. Within 5 minutes, the whole audience, 2,500 people aside, were playing perfectly electronic ping pong on this enormous screen. After this, they played with an aeroplane simulator, one of those things pilots use to learn how to fly, and had the whole audience of 5,000 bringing a plane in to land. And when the whole audience saw that the plane was going to catch its wing as it came in to land in an airstrip in a mountain valley, The whole audience aborted the landing, made the plane take off and go into the sky again, and the whole audience was so delighted they made the plane loop the loop. 5,000 people! Obviously, they possessed that same ability that we're talking about in ancient man. We still have it. It's still there, close to the surface. Now, if you want to know how I think the ancient Egyptians raised 200-ton blocks, I think that they didn't even know that they were doing anything that seemed to be magical, but in some weird way, the priest said, okay, all together, and somehow they did it. And they didn't realize that they'd done something at all strange. And I feel that this is the basic answer to this interesting problem. It's a pity that I don't have time to explain why I feel that human beings have quite deliberately separated themselves. But it did happen after the time when the pyramid was built. We know, as Robert Bova will explain to you, that it was built around about 2,500 and not 10,500 like the Sphinx. But we seem to be fairly certain that the ancient Egyptians were one of the happiest civilizations that ever existed. They lived in a country that was like a tube with the sea at one end, the mountains at the other, and mountains on either side. Their country was flooded with the Nile, producing this magnificent black mud in which they could grow anything. And they felt that they were so favored by the gods that they were the happiest people ever. And everything we know about them shows us that they were, in fact, intensely happy. And then around about 2000 BC, all this began to break up. Suddenly you get a new feeling in Egyptian literature of people being alienated and separated. And little by little you develop the modern mentality. And what interests me so much is that this modern mentality that we've now developed seems to be as far as you can get from this sort of wonderful collective mentality. And yet it's not. You can see how easy it is to, as it were, return to that. Incidentally, Bovall also saw this. I was talking to him on the phone one day, and I said, look, what do you think is all about this ancient Egyptian civilization and mentality? And Robert said, the collective unconscious. And I said, hey, listen to what I've just written, and read him the paragraph that I'd just come up. That's what it's all about, the collective unconscious, and the fact that we can still achieve that. We're still very close to it. In other words, our civilization, which we now regard as something that's, as it were, breaking apart at the seams, is actually coming together. The one thing we've got to realize is that this is so. And once we recognize that this is so, it seems to me that we've taken the most important step in conscious evolution that has ever been taken in the course of the human race. And it seems to me that what has been happening the past 2 or 3 years, the past 5 years, starting with Shuala de Lubitz and John West, and then going on to Graham Hancock and Robert and the things that are now happening, suddenly begins to give us this insight into the past, which is going to completely transform the present moment. And I think I've got to shut up because it's 3 o'clock.
Regarding peak moments, what are your peak moments?
What are my peak moments? Well, I tend to achieve them through a kind of concentration, not through meditation. But at the same time, what seems perfectly obvious to me is that peak experiences are, in a sense, a perfectly simple mechanism. If you think of it, Graham Greene, feeling miserable and low and floppy, so to speak, as if he has no will, and picks up the gun and points it at his head and pulls the trigger and he goes, "Ugh!" And then there's just a click and he goes, "Whew!" And so the basic mechanism of the peak experience is, "Ugh! Whew!" Now, I quickly realized that you could do this without needing a revolver. That what you can do fairly simply is to take any object, you know, take a pen or something like that, and hold it up against a blank wall, and concentrate totally until you see nothing but the pen. Then let your mind expand until you see the wall behind it. And then concentrate again until you see the pen, really putting everything into it as if your life depended on it. Then again, expand. Now, after you've done that about 10 times, it begins to hurt behind the eyes, and you want to stop. Don't stop. Because if you push on then, you go into the peak experience. And you can see that what you've done is the Graham Greene mechanism, but done it more slowly and gradually. That's the method that I use. No, I don't think that Ra and the Ben Ben Stone and all the rest are really very closely related to what I'm saying. What I think Graham Hancock and Robert Bovell have made sort of fairly clear is that the ancient Egyptians regarded their land as a reflection of heaven, and that for some reason the year 2500 BC was the apex of Egyptian history. It was the apex for astronomical reasons that you can read about in their book. I forget what it's called in America, but in England it's called Keeper of Genesis. Message of the Sphinx, yeah. And that the pharaoh served as a kind of mediator, a bit like Jesus in Christianity, that whatever happened in 2500 BC when the pyramid was built, whatever ceremony then took place as the culmination of ages of preparation, somehow was a little like the crucifixion in the Christian religion. Now, I think that the pharaoh was, again, the culmination of something that had been happening since the origin of Cro-Magnon man. Because once you've got a shaman leading a tribe in some kind of ritual which leads into the capture of the prey the next day, that shaman is sooner or later going to become the chief of the tribe. And incidentally, I think very often it was a woman. It was a priestess. Eventually, then, you've got a tribe being led by the priest. And I think that it is at that point that suddenly you're giving people that kind of sense of purpose which they did not have 330,000 BC. I think that a modern dubious example of this would be Adolf Hitler and his Third Reich. But that as soon as you've got a leader who can somehow persuade people we're really going somewhere, the old boring mechanical civilization is finished, and what we're doing is a kind of spiritual Reich, and suddenly everyone, extremely intelligent people, think, my God, yes, this is what we really want. Now, I think that is what happened in ancient Egypt, that you had a totally religious civilization. Schwaller once said that the Egyptians didn't have a religion, they were a religion. Somehow it bound them together. Absolutely, totally. And they were the last great collective unconscious before it began to split apart. And it seems to me that that is the secret of the Egyptian gods and the secret of the ancient Egyptians. There's nothing really to do with peak experiences, which are a typically modern sort of concept. What you can see from ancient Egyptian literature is that people began talking a lot more about individual conscience. They'd been perfectly happy to be a kind of collective, rather like sort of the medieval cathedral builders. And that quite suddenly you begin to get intellectuals who ask questions about individual morality. According to Julian Jaynes, in this extraordinary book, The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind, the great break came sometime around about 1250 BC, as recent as that, when the old type of mentality, something much more collective, something much closer to nature, was suddenly forced to split up because, Jaynes says, of the tremendous problems that suddenly assailed the Mediterranean at this time, problems like the explosion of Santorini, which caused a tidal wave and so on that destroyed most of Greek civilization. And from then on, you've got to struggle like mad just to stay alive. You couldn't afford to be a happy collective. And James thinks that this is suddenly when the gods disappeared and man suddenly found himself standing alone. In other words, when man lost contact with his other half. You see, this is what we're basically talking about is, in a way, the right and the left brain. As you know, you've got two people inside your head living in the left and the right-hand side. And the person who's now listening to me is the person who lives in the left, who's concerned with logic and language and all the rest of it. The person who lives a few centimeters away on the right is actually an artist and so on. As you know, in split brain experiments, the person turns into two people. You show a person a dirty picture with the right side of the brain and they blush. You say, why are you blushing? And they say, I don't know. It's literally that other person. Mozart said that tunes were always walking into his head fully fledged. All he had to do was write them down. Where they came from was that other person on the other side of the brain. Now, obviously, we've split into these two halves. And this split has somehow driven us much further than we would otherwise, because one of the things about being a collective is that you're as happy as a cow. And the point about a cow is that it doesn't really do much. You know, Nietzsche said, we'd like to ask the cows the secret of their happiness, but it's no good because they've forgotten the question before they can give the answer. This is the problem with that collective sort of thing. What we've done is drive ourselves into a new position through, if you like, sheer unhappiness, and suddenly find ourselves in the very interesting position of being able to advance a whole degree further than we ever thought. The Egyptians felt themselves, so to speak, to be creatures of a much bigger universe, part of, so to speak, a domain ruled over by the gods. What the modern human experience is in these moments is, in a sense, a kind of godlike sensation, faculty X, is a feeling that we ourselves possess godlike faculties that can actually drive us further than ever before. And what's more, we can call upon them by learning this trick, which I've been speaking about, this trick of a sudden tremendous concentration of the sort which is caused by sudden crisis. Now, I'm going to have to give you a disappointing answer to that one. When I wrote The Occult, I'd more or less discovered Jung. People kept saying to me, have you realized that Jung's psychological types are roughly the same as your different types of outsider? But I found Jung practically unreadable because he writes so badly. And then, finally, writing The Occult, decided I must read Jung and was completely knocked out by him. He seemed to be tremendous, one of the most important men of the 20th century. And I decided what I would like to do is write an enormous book about Jung. However, I put this idea to a publisher and they wouldn't pay me a big enough advance, so I dropped the idea. And a couple of years later, a small publisher who wanted me to do a little book on Jung persuaded me to do it, and then I began to read through Jung's collective works. And I'm glad I didn't write the big book on Jung, because I finished by feeling that the man's a bloody fake. That there's an element in Jung of the charlatan. That, for example, Jung knew perfectly well he had enough experiences of the paranormal to know what it was all about. In fact, just after the First World War, he was in a cottage, staying in a cottage in Surrey, where they had a poltergeist, which kept sort of banging people on the head and making terrible smells and all the rest of it. And yet, when Jung was asked, sometime after the Second World War, about his experiences of poltergeists and so on, he said, well, I've never actually had any real experience of this sort of thing, so I can't really talk about it from personal knowledge. This sort of desire, you know, not to put his foot into cold water, and again I came across examples of this, that make me feel that Jung, in a sense, was a very great discoverer, but that he lacked a kind of honesty, which meant that, also, of course, he used to go to bed with all his students and his patients. I talked to a close friend of Jung, said, is it true Jung used to screw his patients? And he said, oh, yes, you are. And I can't help feeling, you know, that, I mean, I'm not being morally disapproving or anything of the sort. What I am saying is that, I do feel that when a man has achieved the degree of wisdom that Jung is supposed to have achieved, you don't expect him, sort of as he goes on into his 60s and 70s, to wish to keep on seducing more and more women. And so, on the whole, I am deeply dubious about Jung.